Buddhist Summer School, Thursday morning, 1st September 1977. In that pulse of life, which is creative action in eternity, life and death are simultaneous. We use the term death, but that death is just another name for other life. It is in actuality a life, other life pulse. But we, constituted as we are, not being able to live continuously in that state of deathlessness in innermost awareness, experience this time lag of consciousness. Therefore, we are aware in terms of beginning, ending, birth, death, and we are therefore accustomed to use the terms life and death. Now, in the process of our growth and development through the living of the religious life, as we emerge into full fruition, in that process we undergo innumerable deaths and innumerable births during the single lifetime of the psychophysical organism which bears our name. In this context, the usual terms birth, death, rebirth, re-death have a real factual meaning. Now, the deaths that we undergo in our lifetime are rarely fruitive deaths. They are a disruption, a breaking up, a demolition. But if the death happens to be truly transformative, then you will see that the birth which led to that death is truly an emergence, a productive, fruitful emergence into other life. And this, whether experienced consciously or unconsciously, is a true meaning of spiritual growth. There is the transformative process fulfilling itself completely. And so, through that kind of death, there has been a flowering out towards the full development and expression of our religiousness, of our humanness, in the supreme sense of the word human. Now we must remember this carefully, because in the living of the religious life, if we do really live it, every death can be a fruitive death, provided we are able to be constantly mindful. Constantly mindful. That constant mindfulness is perhaps the most important meaning of meditation. This awareness of what is going on all the time, an awareness in which non-grasping plays perhaps the most important part, means that we are in the state of communion at any and every level of our existence in this world. Therefore, never ward off death. Let death be through non-grasping the transformative process remains unhindered. And if that transformative process remains unhindered, every vestige of selfness ultimately disappears, and selflessness becomes the reality. We remain the finite, identifiable being, but we have now realized that supremely happy condition of living as egoless beings. The whole organism is there, of course, but it is free of the bonds, the boundaries placed upon us by our egohood and our isolated self-consciousness. You remember on Saturday morning we looked into the meaning of the Aryan silence, and the answers given by Moggallana, for instance, that the Aryan silence is the second jhana. The commentary to the Majjhima also shows us the same thing, that it is the second jhana. Then we looked into the Anguttara Nikaya, the passage in which Ananda speaks with the Lord, and we saw that the further development of that Aryan silence extends into the fourth jhana and finally into the supreme state that man can enter, which is called the cessation, the stopping of perception and feeling. Let us look this morning into these jhanas, categorically presented. There are four jhanas, four samapatis, and finally the ninth stage, the cessation. Now jhana, as you know, is the Pali form for dhyana, for meditation in the sense of being fully attentive. The preliminaries necessary for entering the jhana are freeing one's consciousness when one sits down to meditation. This takes place, of course, when one is alone. The preliminaries are setting up mindfulness in front of one. That's the term used. But in actual practice, that setting up mindfulness in front of one consists essentially in turning your attention to what in yoga is called the ajna center, the center between the eyebrows. And it is associated with the pituitary gland, in that region. Now remember, the ajna chakra or center is a term which applies psychically, the psychic energies which are in association with the activity of the physical pituitary body. Don't think of the chakra as being identical with it. So, you let your attention be centered there between the eyebrows to start with. You let the body, the whole organism, quieten down. Your breathing becomes rhythmic, easy, and in that state you free the psyche. Any external turmoil and disturbance which goes on in the brain from all lust, all greed. Next, from all ill will, feelings and thoughts of resentment and so on. You calm down the psychophysical organism. Then you calm down and attune the physical body itself, which may suffer from sloth, from torpor, perhaps from some disinclination which suddenly arises up, or some tiredness which creeps in, from sloth and torpor. And then the whole organism from worry and restlessness. The tendency of the attention to stray away, to dart hither and thither. And fifthly, from doubt. The doubt which is obstructive doubt, a faithless doubt, a doubt which has no confidence in itself. This doubt must be distinguished from that doubt which is the inquiring state of mind, quite open, which says, I don't know. Let me see what is the fact. The doubt which impels you to right investigation. Not that doubt, but this other carping, frightened, diffident doubt. You free yourself from that. And then, devoting attention to whatever your topic of meditation may be, you concentrate your attention upon that. Now, when that process is in full activity, the right activity, you will find that the mind, aloof from sense pleasures and from ill states or unskilled states, enters into the first jhana, which is characterized by applied thought and discursive thinking. Applied thought means specifically directed thought. And discursive thought, which is developing that applied thought, its significances, its implications, and so forth. And it is born of detachment. It is an open investigation. You know already what you are starting with. It is not that state of search which is described as searching for the unborn, but it is a subject which the mind is already acquainted with. It already knows something about it. That's the starting point. When you are truly in it, wholly alive in that state, then there is rapture, there is joy. And in this state one abides. There comes the point when there is the intensification of the state of attentiveness, of awareness. But now, in this attentiveness and this awareness, the attention to a particular thought or subject of thought changes. There is no particular subject. Therefore, as you enter into that intenser state, which is called the second jhana, applied thought and discursive thought cease. The psychical activity, which we call thinking, which is silent talking, completely disappears. You are left with the mind subjectively tranquilized, calm, not hypnotized, not put to sleep, not anesthetized, but truly tranquilized. an active, energetic condition which is far more alive than the first jhana, in which there was applied thought and discursive thinking. And it is fixed on one point. You may also regard it as the inward heart, serene and uniquely exalted in this second jhana. And one abides in it. It is born of concentration, is rapturous and joyful. So you see, that feeling of rapture and joy, which is no longer a disturbing rapture, an exciting rapture, and this inward joy, which is already in the realm of that indefinable joy, which this second jhana brings, is present with you. That is the second jhana. Now this is a very important stage, this entry into the second jhana, when thought, the discursive thought process, completely calms down. The discursive thought process may be compared with the surface disturbance on a lake or in the sea when the winds are blowing and the surface of the water is broken up into waves. Now the waves have completely subsided and the deep calm of the ocean is manifested right up to the surface of the ocean. This is the beginning of the Aryan silence in its full sense. We may call this the movement through the first great portal of death. You have died to the disturbing factors of worldly existence. This is the first death. Now, why is the silence in this sense of such importance? Consider what is represented by words and the movement of thought, which is thinking, which are all words. You remember the nun Dhammadinna says to her ex-husband Visakha, discursive thinking belongs to speech, audible speech, and these are the vocal activities, talking aloud and talking silently in the brain, the vocal activities. Now, what do words and thoughts represent? They represent the finite, the mortal, the limited. When words cease, whilst you are, the body is fully awake and the mind is attentive. If all words cease, in what manner have you become conscious? Words represent everything finite and mortal. But if the very substance of finitude and mortality has become perfectly calm, in what manner are you aware? No longer in the manner of uprising, proceeding, ending, of birth and death, as we know it, in the ordinary meaning of the word death. This is the first entry, just the opening of the door of deathlessness. You are aware in this same world which is around you, in the second jhana, just as much as you are aware of it in the first jhana or in the ordinary everyday waking state. So you pass through the first great portal of death in the house of life. This is an extraordinary experience. And you can abide in this state. Saint Teresa has talked of these things. She didn't know Buddhism or any Eastern teachings. The Avastas or the Upanishads, which present the same thing as that which the Buddha presented. She didn't know anything about it. But she writes about it through and through in parallel terms to what is presented in the Upanishads and in the Buddha's teachings. It's a very extraordinary fact. But there is one big difference between the two presentations. Saint Teresa says that this comes to you because it is entirely, wholly given unto you by grace, through grace. And it lasts only for a fraction of a moment or something like that. The Buddha unequivocally says, and all the holy ones of the East unequivocally say, you can enter upon these states when you are fully master of the whole thing. You can enter upon these states as you please, when you please, and for as long as you please. There is one qualification to the statement, as long as you please, because the time has to come when the body must go through its natural functions. You know, the Buddha says that he can stay 7 nights and 7 days cross-legged in these states. What about your natural functions, bodily functions, eating and taking in sustenance, eliminating, and so forth? You see? So there are limits. For as long as you please means for a very long time, relatively. So this entry into the second jhana, which is the really difficult passage, because the going down of all applied thought and discursive thought is not at all an easy matter. Yourself remaining wide awake, remember, it's an easy matter if sleepiness, drowsiness overcomes you. Then, of course, the thinking vanishes. But that's not it. Hence the emphasis on the importance of being free of sloth and torpor. Torpor mustn't overcome you. You see, In fact, you're more intensely alive and awake in the second jhana than in the first. But the other elements, the rapture and the joy, are still present. Then the third stage, the third jhana, by the fading out of rapture, one dwells with equanimity, complete poise within oneself. This state of dynamic poise, which is not a static condition, it's dynamic, it's this vibrant quiescence of the great cosmic process, of the actual state of chaos in its supreme meaning, which is reflected now in the psychophysical organism which is you. It's that state of poise which is equanimity, upekkha. The ordinary meaning of upekkha in our worldly context, everyday worldly context, is indifference. But never translate upekkha as indifference, because you'll get the wrong meaning of it when applied to the religious life and the deep states of consciousness. So there is perfect equanimity, perfect balance, an extraordinary sensitivity, a state of sensitivity, which enables you to be the receptacle, the Holy Grail, into which transcendent archetypal energies can flow, begin to flow. You see the necessity for all the discipline of religious living, the moralities, the religious observances as they are called, in order to prepare the organism to receive these tremendous energies. I mentioned the analogy of the electric bulb. You are going to receive more increasingly powerful voltages. You see? Right. So, there's the state of equanimity. There is still the experience of joy, of which the Aryans, the worthy ones, the equivalent of the word Aryans in India is the sons of the prophet in the Old Testament. The developed disciples, those who had really learned and grown, begin to be called the sons of the prophet. This is the joy of which the Aryans say, joyful lives he who has equanimity and is mindful, attentive and clearly conscious. Remember the "and clearly conscious," not falling asleep, not self-hypnotized, or anything like that. Now you see, no drugs can do this. Hence the absurdity and the utter wastage, futility, to say nothing of what physical harm ensues of taking drugs in order to have a trip. And then they come back and say, well, they know about it. They don't know about it. Because knowing in this context is identical with being. You remember Plato's teaching? No man should say that he knows this, that and the other, unless he can do it easily, unless he can be it easily, naturally, spontaneously. It has become part and parcel of his very nature, his being. He's at home in it, really at home in it. And so he abides in the third jhana. Now when that attentiveness becomes even more intense, and that awareness becomes more and more rich, inclusive, and going into greater and greater depths, then he enters the fourth jhana. Now in this fourth jhana, all pleasure and pain disappears. There is the going down of the state of rapture, of joy, all that disappears. There is only this complete attentiveness, entirely purified by mindfulness and equanimity. Pure attentiveness. Now, in this pure attentiveness, the psychophysical organism no longer obtrudes itself. This is a very important point. No longer obtrudes itself. You see, when one is concentrating attention, processes inside the body, stimuli from outside in terms of noise or thunder or lightning or something, do cause a slight disturbance or a considerable disturbance of the organism, which interferes with the process of attentiveness. You are still aware, you are still conscious in dualistic terms. You can be disturbed and drawn out of that state. But in this fourth jhana, you have this attentiveness which is complete attentiveness. It is as if the psychophysical organism were not present. I'm not saying dead, because it isn't dead, obviously. But it is as if that psychophysical organism is not present. And in that state, the isolativeness of self-consciousness has begun to die. This is the second great death. You're passing through the second portal of death. This transformative process is reaching its fruition. When you enter the fourth jhana, there is still a certain degree of sensory perception. Still, there is there. There is still, to a certain extent, the functioning of mind which is dependent upon worldly impressions. This is I find it very difficult to put this into words. You may get the feeling of it sometime. It is still dependent, it is still tied to this world. Nevertheless, isolativeness of self-consciousness has begun to cease altogether. And when you pass completely beyond the perception of form, when you are beyond the perception of all sensory reactions, there are no more sensory reactions taking place, by not attending to any perceptions which arise in the mind, any perceptions of variety, which means differentiation, which keeps you in the realm of finitude still, because there is no such thing as differentiation apart from finitude. By becoming aware that akasha, this word so difficult to translate into European languages, you are aware then that akasha is immeasurable. And your consciousness, which was a discriminative consciousness, an analytical discriminative consciousness, your vijnana, finishes with discrimination. It finishes with finitude, in other words. And that is the first samapatti, the fifth stage. When awareness has finished with discriminative functioning, then it is actually living, it is actually functioning in the state of the non-finite, the birthless, deathless. It is beginning to function in terms of the life, other life pulse. It's getting more and more into tune with that. And it is associated, the infinity of akasha, as it is called, is associated with the infinity of vijnana, which is really, if we put it into our poor, halting human languages now, which is really functioning in terms of wholeness, of the unitary wholeness. And that time consciousness, the passage of time, does not touch you anymore. This is the first experiencing of that which is represented by the word eternity. When akasha, we'll use the word space for convenience, for akasha. When space-time, akasha vijnana, are functioning in that state of togetherness as an integrated whole, this is why you have heard me say that it was an extraordinary flash on the part of Einstein to postulate the integrated space-time. Here, the perfected Holy One actually experiences and lives in awareness, the integrated space-time, something which you can't imagine, something which you can't, about which you can't present a logical structure. See, this is actually realized. This samapatti, where the two samapattis, where the infinity of space and the infinity of consciousness have become a unity. If you can begin to sort of grow, to understand this, get the feel of it, you will understand why in the Upanishads, again and again, the perfected Holy One declares, I am the all, the totality. Remember in connection with that, and this will help you to understand it a little more easily, perhaps, in that wonderful Upanishad, the Tejo Bindu, which is one of the great Upanishads of the yoga, of the group of yoga Upanishads. Shiva, the third person of the Trinity, and this is what makes it so significant. It takes you right to the level of the creator, the regenerator, and the reabsorber of the whole universal process. Shiva, in that sense, corresponds to the Holy Ghost in the Christian Trinity. You see? Shiva answers the disciples' request to explain who he is, what he is, and so forth. And he says, I am this, I am that, I am the other, everything is said. Mind you, it's the disciple himself who says this. There is no separate person called Shiva or the third person of the Trinity. It is his own state of profound awareness from which this comes and is expressed in this language. And one of the most significant things he says is, I am the I which has given up I. Separate I-hood has completely vanished in every shape and form. Now, there is something very important in this connection. When one realizes this infinity of akasha vijnana, the archetypal forces enter your constitution, your psychophysical constitution, quite freely. And he who practices any of the Brahma Viharas, the abiding in Metta, in Karuna, in Mudita, takes place in all its richness. This is the real Brahma Viharic residing. Brahma Vihara means the residence of Brahma, the Supreme. Vihara is residence. And whenever any of the monks or questioners requested the Buddha to show them the way to union with Brahma, the Buddha presents the teaching of the Brahma Viharas. Now, when we attempt to practice the Brahma Vihara, we just go through a verbal ritual. The efficacy and the power of that verbal ritual depends upon the extent to which we have developed, which enables us to vibrate at our lower level in tune with these the level of these archetypal forces. You see? But here, in this state, those archetypal energies experience no obstruction in the psychophysical, or presented by the psychophysical organism of the meditator. So the real Brahma-viharic practice reaches its fullness there. It's an important point to remember. Then, by passing beyond the infinite akasha stage, one enters, as they say, the plane of nothing. In the infinity of akasha vijnana, there is the complete union of love and wisdom. We talk of them separately. Necessarily we must, at our level. But transcendent love, which functions at this level, transcendent wisdom, which functions at this level, are two terms for the same unitary reality. There is no such thing as love which is not wisdom also. There is no such thing as wisdom which simultaneously is not love. Love, wisdom become a unity. In this realm of nothing, the awareness in the realm of nothing, because of love, wisdom, lays to rest all the archetypal pictures which we know of even at our level, represented in all the great religions as the archangels, angels, and so forth. They are names to express through personification the main forms of transcendent energy, primordial energy, as it functions through the entire universe. Now, the names of the archangels and angels are different in the different religions, and although their fundamental meanings correspond in terms of words and thought and so forth, there are variations due to the different cultural heritages and the actual material conditions of the land in which we were born and were nurtured and grew up. In the plane of nothing, all these are laid to rest. They dissolve. You dismiss the gods. You send them back home to their eternal rest, as far as you, the particular one, the particular individual, are concerned. This is an extraordinary thing to say. Now you see what meaning there is when the Buddha says, then Brahma Sahampati suddenly appeared before me, arranged his robe over his right shoulder, bowed to me with joined palms. These are the names of archetypal energies. You see, it's one of the extraordinary subtle pieces of evidence of what is implied in these names of the gods and the angels and so forth. And those archetypal figures, modern psychology has talked of these archetypal figures. Plato talked of the archetypes, but with a difference, as far as I'm aware, as far as I can see, with a difference from the way in which our modern psychology presents the archetypes. Plato presented three great archetypes: truth, goodness, beauty. You see? But those were in terms of absoluteness, not of something relative, not of something which can hold you in bondage. The way the archetypes affect us in our ordinary everyday life is different from the way in which the archetypal energies function in relation to the Holy One's consciousness. Quite different. But all these archetypal forces which do exercise a conditioning influence right up to the fourth jhana. And then when the passage through the first two samapattis take place, and remember the meaning I gave you of samapatti, don't confine yourself to the meaning in the Pali dictionary or the Sanskrit dictionary of attainment. It is coalescence. The energies of which the psychophysical organism is a limited expression, they have now become so pure, so free from within the organism, that they are healthily and safely at one with the universal archetypal energies. And all these are laid to rest. You dismiss the gods, you dismiss the demons. You are becoming increasingly thee alone. And remember, transcendence itself is thee alone, which includes totality. It's not lonely, it's not separated, but it is wholly inclusive of totality. This is the plane of nothing. And on this plane of nothing, there is still transcendental perception and feeling, for there is nothing in the realm of manifestation which will not yield up its secret to you if you turn attention to it. And the awareness which is present in that exalted state, there are absolutely no words in any language which can represent that. We can only use our own words, perception and feeling. So do realize that in this final samapatti, the eighth stage, which is called neither perception nor non-perception, neva sanya, na sanya. You see? Neither perception nor not perception. In that state, the transcendental perception and feeling comes to its close. And when that comes to its close, there is the cessation which the Buddha called the supreme state. one enters upon and abides in the stopping of perception and feeling. On passing through the infinity of Akasha and Vijnana, then, you pass through the third great portal of death, of transformation. You are now in that halfway house between the final state of change possible to you, when it is neither perception nor non-perception, and in the cessation you are beyond all change. This is the meaning of the statement made in the religions, especially the theistic religions, that God is the immutable one, the changeless one. And yet, this ultimate is the origin, the source of all change, when there is cosmic manifestation. You are at one with that vibrant quiescence. Mortality is completely transcended in any and every form. The body does not decay whilst you are in the cessation. It doesn't decay. And when that comes to its close, there is the cessation which the Buddha called the supreme state. One enters upon and abides in the stopping of perception and feeling. On passing through the infinity of Akasha and Vijnana, then, you pass through the third great portal of death, of transformation. You are now in that halfway house between the final state of change possible to you, when it is neither perception nor non-perception, and in the cessation you are beyond all change. This is the meaning of the statement made in the religions, especially the theistic religions, that God is the immutable one, the changeless one. And yet, this ultimate is the origin, the source of all change, when there is cosmic manifestation. You are at one with that vibrant quiescence. Mortality is completely transcended in any and every form. The body does not decay whilst you are in the cessation. It doesn't decay. If you remain in that cessation for 7 whole days, the body continues recharged, reinvigorated, when you come back from the cessation back to ordinary consciousness. But immortality has been actually realized. It has been actually realized in our, and when we are talking about, we talk in our material terms, through a time period of 7 days. As much as that is possible. Now you understand why I use that peculiar phrase, eternity rides on the wings of time. Thank you.
Now just as eternity rides on the wings of time, immortality is manifest in us and in our lives through the pendulum-like movement which we call birth, death. Mortality is an instrument for the realization of immortality. And immortality, therefore, in itself has no relationship to the idea that you live continuously through time and space. All statements like an everlasting heaven or an everlasting hell, if you like, are wholly misleading statements. Because when consciousness has gone right beyond all this, the word everlasting in the sense of continuity through time has no meaning whatever. And it is with reference to that sort of realization where the unconditioned has become a complete reality through you and in you, the conditioned psychophysical organism. It is in relation to that that these lines in the last canto of the Dhammapada, the 26th one, have meaning for us. It starts, the first verse starts, strive and stop the stream. Discard, O Brahman. Note how the Buddha constantly uses the word Brahman in the Hindu sense, because these were Brahmins who came to him. He was a Kshatriya by birth. You see, he belonged to the warrior class, the ruling class, the administrators, and so on. So he talks in terms of addressing Brahmins. Discard, O Brahman, sense desires. Now, having known the destruction of the constituents of existence, O Brahman, become a knower of the uncreated, of the unconditioned. All the sankharas are completely resolved back into primordial chaos. All that is put together is a sankhara. You see, anything that is, any finite manifestation that is put together is a sankhara. When you have disrupted the sankhara through purification, through non-grasping, you have resolved and released the bound into the freedom of the absolutely unbound. Suddenly in my mind there emerges towards the end of the Tempest, Shakespeare's Tempest, Prospero says to Ariel, go free now. Ariel is a sankhara, a put together. The realm of mind, remember, he is not a physical being. is just practical. Resolved back into primordial reality. It's a wonderful thing. So this dissolution of all the sankharas, you will recall, was one of the very difficult things composing this matter so difficult to see that the Buddha talked of after the enlightenment. Whom shall I teach? This matter is so difficult to see. The tranquilizing of all the sankharas. Now you see the importance of these jhanas and samapattis. The tranquilizing. The word used there is the destruction of what is put together. But it is not so much destruction. It is an unraveling of the complicated ball of thread. It's all straightened out completely. Penelope unraveling at night what she raveled during the daytime. Release, complete and utter release. The Buddha uses the term that unshakable freedom of mind. When we understand this, we understand death, what we call death. Death as the consummator, the perfector. Christian mysticism, I keep on mentioning Christian mysticism and so forth because it belongs to, you belong to that culture by birth. By upbringing. Christian mysticism teaches that the supreme gift of God to us alive here is death. You see, it's the great portal of entry into the immortal, the deathless. Those who are, who succeed in being real Christians, realize the deathless as much as the Buddhist or the Hindu or the Zarathustrian realizes death. That is to say, this other life in totality, in infinity, manifests itself here and now whilst you are alive. Now you'll see, there is no such thing as immortality in a hereafter. After the death of the, after the disruption of the psychophysical organism, as the Buddha said, neither gods nor men will ever see him again. And he refers to himself in the third person, will ever see him again. The Tathagata, who in actual functioning whilst alive as Tathagata is declared to be trackless, immeasurable. You can't find him. There is no isolated, self-conscious him during his lifetime. And when the lifetime ends, there is the release into total and complete non-being. The unconditioned. Do try and get hold of this. You see? Because if you understand this, you will never prevent death in its profound and real sense. That does not mean that if you fall ill, you should just say, now the release into perfect non-being will come. It won't until you have realized Samasambodhi here. Don't forget that, you see. But if you understand this, you will understand why the author of the Gita, who was a perfected holy one, presents his realization of the supreme states in terms of that divine dialogue between Sri Krishna, the embodied Lord of the universe, which is the author of the Gita himself in the supreme state of consciousness, of awareness, you see, the cessation. He realized that. So Sri Krishna represents him in that condition. And Arjuna represents the author of the Gita in his ordinary worldly consciousness. Don't think, I'm a frightful heretic that way. And the Hindu world will certainly throw bricks at me for writing that in the Heart of Religion, in the chapter on the Bhagavad Gita, that it is the author of the Gita himself who is Krishna, himself who is Arjuna, and he presents this realization and the path to that realization in terms of the divine dialogue. Remember his words, Sri Krishna's words. Being and non-being am I. Death am I, and the origin of all things to come. Now consider. Being, the obvious manifested being here, and non-being, am I. So non-being is not non-existence, complete non-existence. No such thing as annihilation. The Buddha says, you, the personality, will disappear absolutely. There is nothing for you in a hereafter when the body, when the psychophysical organism dies. No survival of the identifiable entity. But in saying that non-being am I, the implication, the clear implication and significance is that there is no such thing as annihilation. This has resolved back into the infinite. The one unitary whole which is the immortal itself, which is life itself. Life which includes that pulsation which you and I ordinarily call birth and death. You see? Being and non-being am I. If the word I is applied to non-being, it is applied to the non-finite, the immeasurable. And none of our criteria applied there. And in that state of non-being, there is no separate, identifiable entity. It cannot be. He is both. In the supreme state of awareness, that is actually made real in and through the living psychophysical organism, which is perfectly quiet, perfectly stilled. And that state of awareness is actually functioning. Opened are the doors of the deathless, as the Buddha said. There is no barrier between this here and that there. This and that have realized the final coalescence in actual fact. Is it any wonder that in the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara, Avalokita, he who looks down, looks into, with infinite wisdom, infinite compassion, realizing that, beholds that the psychophysical organism are five heaps: rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, vijnana. And they are empty of reality. Reality in this sense, if I not mistaken, and I do hope I am not, otherwise I'll be misleading you. Reality in that sense is this pulse of life, this creative pulse of the creative power which manifests as life, other life, life, other life. Being, non-being, being, non-being. Don't try to visualize it. You merely make imaginative pictures, however pleasant and inspiring they may be. All pictures are out in that realm of supreme realization. He looks down, beholds the five heaps. And then when he proceeds, after he has said that here, O Sariputta, that is to say, in that state, form is emptiness, the void, the full void, the plenum void, because it is creative energy itself producing forms, withdrawing forms, and so forth. And then he goes on to say, here there is neither earth, air, this, that, and the other. No birth, no rebirth. No dukkha, no ignorance, no cause, no effect, and so on. Negating everything, exactly as Yajnavalkya in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad says, the Atma is not this, not this, not this. And he ends up with respect to such a realization with those wonderful words, gate gate, par gate, par sangate, bodhi swaha, gone, gone, gone altogether beyond. Oh, what an awakening, all fails.